Chapter 26. The Great Turning Point, 1942. Stalingrad and El Alamein. The conspirators come back to life. The severe setback to Hitler's armies in Russia during the winter of 1941-42, and the cashiering of a number of field marshals and top generals, ignited the hopes of the anti-Nazi conspirators again. They had been unable to interest the leading commanders in a revolt as long as their armies were smashing to one easy victory after another, and the glory of German arms and of the German Reich was soaring to the heavens. But now the proud and hitherto invincible soldiers were falling back in the snow and bitter cold before an enemy which had proved their match. Casualties in 6 months had passed the million mark, and a host of the most renowned generals were being summarily dismissed. Some of them, such as Hoeppner and Sponeck, publicly disgraced, and most of the others humiliated and made scapegoats of by the ruthless dictator. Among those retired, it will be recalled, were Field Marshal von Brauchitsch, the commander-in-chief of the army, and Field Marshals von Rundstedt and von Bock, who led the southern and central army groups respectively, and General Guderian, the genius of the Panzer Corps. The commander of the army group in the north, Field Marshal von Leib, soon followed, being relieved of his post on January 18, 1942. The day before, Field Marshal von Reichenau, who had taken over Rundstedt's command, died of a stroke. General Udet of the Luftwaffe shot himself to death on November 17, 1941. Moreover, some 35 corps and divisional commanders were replaced during the winter retreat. This, of course, was only a beginning. Field Marshal von Manstein summed up at Nuremberg what happened to the generals when they started losing battles or finally got up enough courage to oppose Hitler. Of 17 field marshals, he told the tribunal, 10 were sent home during the war and 3 lost their lives as a result of July 20, 1944, the plot against Hitler. Only one field marshal managed to get through the war and keep his position. Of 36 full generals, Generaloberste, 18 were sent home, and 5 died as a result of July 20th or were dishonorably discharged. Only 3 full generals survived the war in their positions. The time is almost ripe, Hassel concluded hopefully in his diary on December 21st, 1941. He and his fellow conspirators were sure that the Prussian officer corps would react not only to their shabby treatment, but to the madness of their supreme commander in leading them and their armies to the brink of disaster in the Russian winter. The plotters had long been convinced, as we have seen, that only the generals in command of troops had the physical power to overthrow the Nazi tyrant. Now was their chance before it was too late. Timing was all important. The war, they saw, after the reverses in Russia and the entry of America into the conflict, could no longer be won. But neither was it yet lost. An anti-Nazi government in Berlin could still get peace terms, they thought, which would leave Germany a major power, and perhaps with at least some of Hitler's gains, such as Austria, the Sudetenland, and Western Poland. These thoughts had been very much in their minds at the end of the summer of 1941, even when the prospect of destroying the Soviet Union was still good. The text of the Atlantic Charter, which Churchill and Roosevelt had drawn up on August 19th, had come as a heavy blow to them, especially Point 8, which had stipulated that Germany would have to be disarmed after the war pending a general disarmament agreement. To Hassel, Gerdeler, Beck, and the other members of their opposition circle, this meant that the Allies had no intention of distinguishing between Nazi and anti-Nazi Germans, and was proof, as Hassel put it, that England and America are not fighting only against Hitler, but also want to smash Germany and render her defenseless. Indeed, to this aristocratic former ambassador, now deep in treason against Hitler but determined to get as much as possible for a Germany without Hitler, Point 8, as he noted in his journal, destroys every reasonable chance for peace. Disillusioned though they were by the Atlantic Charter, the conspirators seemed to have been spurred to action by its promulgation, if only because it impressed them with the necessity of doing away with Hitler while there was yet time for an anti-Nazi regime to bargain advantageously for peace for a Germany which still held most of Europe. They were not adverse to using Hitler's conquests to obtain the most favorable terms for their country. The upshot of a series of talks in Berlin during the last days of August between Hassel, Popitz, Oster, Dohnányi, and General Friedrich Ulbricht, chief of staff of the Home Army, was that the German patriots, as they called themselves, would make very moderate demands of the Allies. But, to quote Hassel again, there are certain claims from which they could not desist. What the demands and claims were, he does not say. One gathers from other entries in his diary that they amounted to an insistence on Germany's 1914 frontiers in the east, plus Austria and the Sudetenland. But time pressed. After a final conference with his Confederates at the end of August, Hassel wrote in his diary, "They were unanimously convinced that it would soon be too late. When our chances for victory are obviously gone or only very slim, there will be nothing more to be done." There had been some effort to induce key generals on the Eastern Front to arrest Hitler during the summer campaign in Russia. But though it inevitably proved ineffectual because the great captains were naturally too absorbed in their initial stunning victories to give any thought to overthrowing the man who had given them the opportunity to achieve them, it did plant some seeds among the military minds that would eventually sprout. The center of the conspiracy in the army that summer was in the headquarters of Field Marshal von Bock, whose army group center was driving on Moscow. Major General Henning von Treskow, of Bock's staff, whose early enthusiasm for National Socialism had so soured as to land him in the ranks of the plotters, was the ringleader, and he was assisted by Fabian von Schlabrendorf, his ADC, and by two fellow conspirators whom they had planted on Bock as ADCs, Count Hans von Hardenberg and Count Heinrich von Lehndorf, both scions of old and prominent German families. Lehndorf was executed by the Nazis on September 4, 1944. One of their self-appointed tasks was to work on the field marshal and to persuade him to arrest Hitler on one of his visits to the army group's headquarters. But Bock was hard to work on. Though professing to loathe Nazism, he had advanced too far under it and was much too vain and ambitious to take any chances at this stage of the game. Once, when Treskow tried to point out to him that the Führer was leading the country to disaster, Bock shouted, "I do not allow the Führer to be attacked." Treskow and his young aide were discouraged, but not daunted. They decided to act on their own. When, on August 4, 1941, the Führer visited the Army Group's headquarters at Borisov, they planned to seize him as he was driving from the airfield to Bock's quarters. But the plotters were still amateurs at this time and had not counted on the Führer's security arrangements. Surrounded by his own SS bodyguards and declining to use one of the Army Group's automobiles to drive in from the airfield, he had sent ahead his own fleet of cars for this purpose, he gave the two officers no opportunity of getting near him. This fiasco, apparently there were others like it, taught the plotters who were in the army some lessons. The first was that to get their hands on Hitler was no easy job. He was always well guarded. Another was that to seize him and arrest him might not solve the problem, since the key generals were too cowardly or too confused about their oaths of allegiance to help the opposition to carry on from there. It was about this time, the fall of 1941, that some of the young officers in the army, many of them civilians in uniform like Schlabrendorf, reluctantly came to the conclusion that the simplest and perhaps the only solution was to kill Hitler. Then the timid generals, released from their personal oaths to the leader, would go along with the new regime and give it the support of the army. But the ringleaders in Berlin were not yet ready to go so far. They were concocting an idiotic plan called isolated action, which for some reason they thought would satisfy the consciences of the generals about breaking their personal oaths to the Führer, and at the same time enable them to rid the Reich of Hitler. It is difficult even today to follow their minds in this, but the idea was that the top military commanders, both in the East and in the West, would simply, on a prearranged signal, refuse to obey the orders of Hitler as commander-in-chief of the army. This, of course, would have been breaking their oath of obedience to the Führer, but the sophists in Berlin pretended not to see that. They explained, at any event, that the real purpose of the scheme was to create confusion, in the midst of which Beck, with the help of detachments of the Home Army in Berlin, would seize power, depose Hitler, and outlaw National Socialism. The Home Army, however, was scarcely a military force, but more a motley collection of recruits doing a little basic training before being shipped as replacements to the front. Some top generals in Russia or in the occupation zones who had seasoned troops at their command would have to be won over if the venture were really to succeed. One of them, who had been in on the Halder plot to arrest Hitler at the time of Munich, seemed a natural choice. This was Field Marshal von Witzleben, who was now commander-in-chief in the West. To initiate him and also General Alexander von Falkenhausen, the military commander in Belgium, into the new scheme of things, Hassel was sent by the conspirators in mid-January 1942 to confer with the two generals. Already under surveillance by the Gestapo, the former ambassador used the cover of a lecture tour, addressing groups of German officers and occupation officials on the subject of living space and imperialism. In between lectures, he conferred privately with Falkenhausen in Brussels and Witzleben in Paris, receiving a favorable impression of both of them, especially of the latter. Shunted to the sidelines in France while his fellow field marshals were fighting great battles in Russia, Witzleben was thirsting for action. He told Hassel that the idea of isolated action was utopian. Direct action to overthrow Hitler was the only solution, and he was willing to play a leading part. Probably the best time to strike would be during the summer of 1942, when the German offensive in Russia was resumed. To prepare for the day, he intended to be in top physical trim and would have a minor operation to put him in shape. Unfortunately for the field marshal and his co-conspirators, this decision had disastrous consequences. Like Frederick the Great and many others, Witzleben was troubled by hemorrhoids. The Prussian king often complained about this malady, which he found hampered his mental facilities as well as his physical activities. The operation to correct this painful and annoying condition was a routine case of surgery, to be sure. But when Witzleben took a brief sick leave in the spring to have it done, Hitler took advantage of the situation to retire the field marshal from active service, replacing him with Rundstedt, who had no stomach for conspiring against the leader who had so recently treated him so shabbily. Thus the plotters found their chief hope in the army to be a field marshal without any troops at his command. Without soldiers, no new regime could be established. The leaders of the conspiracy were greatly disheartened. They kept meeting clandestinely and plotting, but they could not overcome their discouragement. It seems at the moment, Hassel noted at the end of February 1942, after one of the innumerable meetings, that nothing can be done about Hitler. A great deal could be done, however, about straightening out their ideas concerning the kind of government they wanted for Germany after Hitler finally was deposed, and about strengthening their helter-skelter and so far quite ineffectual organization so that it could take over that government when the time came. Most of the resistance leaders, being conservative and well on in years, wanted, for one thing, a restoration of the Hohenzollern monarchy. But for a long time they could not agree on which Hohenzollern prince to hoist on the throne. Popitz, one of the leading civilians in the ring, wanted the crown prince, who was anathema to most of the others. Schacht favored the oldest son of the crown prince, Prince Wilhelm, and Gerdeler, the youngest surviving son of Wilhelm II, Prince Oscar of Prussia. All were in accord that the Kaiser's fourth son, Prince August Wilhelm, or Aui as he was nicknamed, was out of the question since he was a fanatical Nazi and a Gruppenführer in the SS. By the summer of 1941, however, there was more or less agreement that the most suitable candidate for the throne was Louis Ferdinand, the second and oldest surviving son of the Crown Prince. Prince Wilhelm, the oldest son, had died of battle wounds in France on May 26, 1940. Then just 33, a veteran of 5 years in the Ford factory at Dearborn, a working employee of the Lufthansa Airlines and in contact and in sympathy with the plotters, this personable young man had finally emerged as the most desirable of the Hohenzollerns. He understood the 20th century, was democratic and intelligent. Moreover, he had an attractive, sensible, and courageous wife in Princess Kira, a former Russian Grand Duchess, and, an important point for the conspirators at this stage, he was a personal friend of President Roosevelt, who had invited the couple to stay in the White House during their American honeymoon in 1938. Hassel and some of his friends were not absolutely convinced that Louis Ferdinand was an ideal choice. "He lacks many qualities he cannot get along without," Hassel commented wryly in his diary at Christmas time, 1941, but he went along with the others. Hassel's chief interest was in the form and nature of the future German government, and early the year before he had drawn up, after consultation with General Beck, Gerdeler, and Popitz, a program for its interim stage, which he refined in a further draft at the end of 1941. It restored individual freedom and, pending the adoption of a permanent constitution, provided for the supreme power to rest in the hands of a regent, who, as head of state, would appoint a government and a council of state. It was all rather authoritarian, and Girdler and the few trade union representatives among the conspirators didn't like it, proposing instead an immediate plebiscite so that the interim regime would have popular backing and give proof of its democratic character. But for the lack of something better, Hassel's plan was generally accepted, at least as a statement of principles, until it was superseded by a liberal and enlightened program drawn up in 1943 under pressure from the Kreisau Circle, led by Count Helmut von Moltke. Finally, that spring of 1942, the conspirators formally adopted a leader. They had all acknowledged General Beck as such, not only because of his intelligence and character, but also because of his prestige among the generals, his good name in the country, and his reputation abroad. However, they had been so lackadaisical in organizing that they had never actually put him in charge. A few, like Hassel, though full of admiration and respect for the former general staff chief, had some doubts about him. "The principal difficulty with Beck," Hassel wrote in his diary shortly before Christmas 1941, "is that he is very theoretical, as Popitz says, a man of tactics but little willpower." This judgment, as it turned out, was not an ungrounded one, and this quirk in the general's temperament and character, this surprising lack of a will to act, was to prove tragic and disastrous in the end. Nevertheless, in March 1942, after a good many secret meetings, the plotters decided, as Hassel reported, that Beck must hold the strings. And at the end of the month, as the ambassador further noted, Beck was formally adopted as the head of our group. Still, the conspiracy remained nebulous, and the air of unreality which surrounded even the most active members of it from the first hangs over their endless talk as one tries to follow it at this stage in the records they have left. Hitler, they knew that spring, was planning to resume the offensive in Russia as soon as the ground was dry. This, they felt, could only plunge Germany farther toward the abyss. And yet, though they talked much, they did nothing. On March 28, 1942, Hassel sat in his country house at Ebenhausen and began his diary. "During the last days in Berlin, I had detailed discussions with Jessen, Beck, and Girdler. Prospects not very good." How could they be very good, without even any plans to act, now, while there was still time? Jens-Peter Jessen, a professor of economics at the University of Berlin, was one of the brains of the circle. He had become an ardent Nazi during the period between 1931 and 1933, and was one of the few genuine intellectuals in the party. He was quickly disillusioned after 1933 and soon became a fanatical anti-Nazi. Arrested for complicity in the July 20, 1944 plot against Hitler, he was executed at the Plötzensee prison in Berlin in November of that year. It was Adolf Hitler who, at this unfolding of spring, the third of the war, had plans, and the fierce will, to try to carry them out. The last great German offensives of the war. Although the Führer's folly in refusing to allow the German armies in Russia to retreat in time had led to heavy losses in men and arms, to the demoralization of many commands, and to a situation which for a few weeks in January and February 1942 threatened to end in utter catastrophe, there is little doubt that Hitler's fanatical determination to hold on and to stand and fight also helped to stem the Soviet tide. The traditional courage and endurance of the German soldiers did the rest. By February 20th, the Russian offensive from the Baltic to the Black Sea had run out of steam, and at the end of March, the season of deep mud set in, bringing a relative quiet to the long and bloody front. Both sides were exhausted. A German army report of March 30th, 1942, revealed what a terrible toll had been paid in the winter fighting. Of a total of 162 combat divisions in the east, only 8 were ready for offensive missions. The 16 armored divisions had between them only 140 serviceable tanks, less than the normal number for one division. While the troops were resting and refitting, indeed long before that, while they were still retreating in the midwinter snows, Hitler, who was now commander-in-chief of the army as well as supreme commander of the armed forces, had been busy with plans for the coming summer's offensive. They were not as ambitious as those of the previous year. By now he had sense enough to see that he could not destroy all of the Red Armies in a single campaign. This summer he would concentrate the bulk of his forces in the south, conquer the Caucasus oil fields, the Donetsk industrial basin, and the wheat fields of the Kuban, and take Stalingrad on the Volga. This would accomplish several prime objectives. It would deprive the Soviets of the oil and much of the food and industry they desperately needed to carry on the war, while giving the Germans the oil and the food resources they were almost as badly in need of. "If I do not get the oil of Maikop and Grozny," Hitler told General Paulus, the commander of the ill-fated Sixth Army, just before the summer offensive began, "then I must end this war." Stalin could have said almost the same thing. He, too, had to have the oil of the Caucasus to stay in the war. That was where the significance of Stalingrad came in. German possession of it would block the last main route via the Caspian Sea and the Volga River, over which the oil, as long as the Russians held the wells, could reach central Russia. Besides oil to propel his planes and tanks and trucks, Hitler needed men to fill out his thinned ranks. Total casualties at the end of the winter fighting were 1,167,835, exclusive of the sick, and there were not enough replacements available to make up for such losses. The high command turned to Germany's allies, or rather satellites, for additional troops. During the winter, General Keitel had scurried off to Budapest and Bucharest to drum up Hungarian and Romanian soldiers, whole divisions of them, for the coming summer. Goering and finally Hitler himself appealed to Mussolini for Italian formations. Goering arrived in Rome at the end of January 1942 to line up Italian reinforcements for Russia, assuring Mussolini that the Soviet Union would be defeated in 1942 and that Great Britain would lay down her arms in 1943. Ciano found the fat, bemedaled Reich Marshal insufferable. "As usual, he is bloated and overbearing," the Italian foreign minister noted in his diary on February 2nd. 2 days later, "Goering leaves Rome. We had dinner at the Excelsior Hotel, and during the dinner Goering talked of little else but the jewels he owned. In fact, he had some beautiful rings on his fingers. On the way to the station he wore a great sable coat, something between what automobile drivers wore in 1906 and what a high-grade prostitute wears to the opera." The corruption and corrosion of the number two man in the Third Reich was making steady progress. Mussolini promised Goering to send two Italian divisions to Russia in March if the Germans would give them artillery, but his concern about his allies' defeats on the Eastern Front grew to such proportions that Hitler decided it was time for another meeting to explain how strong Germany still was. This took place on April 29th and 30th at Salzburg, where the Duce and Ciano and their party were put up in the Baroque Palace of Klesheim, once the seat of the prince-bishops and now redecorated with hangings, furniture, and carpets from France, for which the Italian foreign minister suspected the Germans did not pay too much. Ciano found the Führer looking tired. "The winter months in Russia have borne heavily upon him," he noted in his diary. "I see for the first time that he has many gray hairs." Goebbels had seen Hitler a month before at headquarters and expressed shock in his diary at his ailing. "I noted that he has already become quite gray. He told me he has to fight off severe attacks of giddiness. The Führer this time truly worries me." He had, Goebbels added, a physical revulsion against frost and snow. "What worries and torments the Führer most is that the country is still covered with snow." The Goebbels Diaries, pages 131 to 137. There followed the usual German recital sizing up the general situation, with Ribbentrop and Hitler assuring their Italian guests that all was well, in Russia, in North Africa, in the West, and on the high seas. The coming offensive in the East, they confided, would be directed against the Caucasus oil fields. "When Russia's sources of oil are exhausted," Ribbentrop said, "she will be brought to her knees. Then the British will bow in order to save what remains of the mauled empire. America is a big bluff." Ciano, listening more or less patiently to his opposite number, got the impression, however, that in regard to what the United States might eventually do, it was the Germans who were bluffing, and that in reality, when they thought of it, they feel shivers running down their spines. It was the Führer who, as always, did most of the talking. "Hitler talks, talks, talks," Ciano wrote in his diary. "Mussolini suffers. He, who is in the habit of talking himself, and who, instead, practically has to keep quiet. On the second day after lunch, when everything had been said, Hitler talked uninterruptedly for an hour and 40 minutes. He omitted absolutely no argument, War and Peace, Religion and Philosophy, Art and History. Mussolini automatically looked at his wristwatch. The Germans, poor people, have to take it every day, and I am certain there isn't a gesture, a word, or a pause which they don't know by heart. General Jodl, after an epic struggle, finally went to sleep on the divan. Keitel was reeling, but he succeeded in keeping his head up. He was too close to Hitler to let himself go. Despite the avalanche of talk, or perhaps because of it, Hitler got the promise of more Italian cannon fodder for the Russian front. So successful were he and Keitel with all the satellites that the German high command calculated it would have 52 Allied divisions available for the summer's task. 27 Romanian, 13 Hungarian, 9 Italian, 2 Slovak, and 1 Spanish. This was one quarter of the combined Axis force in the east. Of the 41 fresh divisions which were to reinforce the southern part of the front, where the main German blow would fall, one half, or 21 divisions, were Hungarian, 10, Italian, 6, and Romanian, 5. Halder and most of the other generals did not like to stake so much on so many foreign divisions whose fighting qualities, in their opinion, were, to put it mildly, questionable. But because of their own shortage of manpower, they reluctantly accepted this aid, and this decision was shortly to contribute to the disaster which ensued. At first, that summer of 1942, the fortunes of the Axis prospered. Even before the jump off toward the Caucasus and Stalingrad, a sensational victory was scored in North Africa. On May 27, 1942, General Rommel had resumed his offensive in the desert. In a savage series of battles with the British in November and December 1941, Rommel's forces had been driven back clear across Cyrenaica to the El Agheila line at its western borders. But bounding back with his customary resilience in January 1942, Rommel recaptured half of the ground lost in a swift 17-day campaign which brought him back to El Ghazala, from where the new drive of the end of May 1942 began. Striking swiftly with his famed Afrika Corps, 2 armored divisions and a motorized infantry division, and 8 Italian divisions, of which 1 was armored, he soon had the British Desert Army reeling back toward the Egyptian frontier. On June 21st, he captured Tobruk, the key to the British defenses, which in 1941 had held out for 9 months until relieved, and 2 days later he entered Egypt. By the end of June, he was at El Alamein, 65 miles from Alexandria and the delta of the Nile. It seemed to many a startled Allied statesman, poring over a map, that nothing could now prevent Rommel from delivering a fatal blow to the British by conquering Egypt, and then, if he were reinforced, sweeping on northeast to capture the great oil fields of the Middle East, and then to the Caucasus to meet the German armies in Russia, which already were beginning their advance toward that region from the north. It was one of the darkest moments of the war for the Allies, and correspondingly one of the brightest for the Axis. But Hitler, as we have seen, had never understood global warfare. He did not know how to exploit Rommel's surprising African success. He awarded the daring leader of the Afrika Korps a field marshal's baton, but he did not send him supplies or reinforcements. Hitler's naming Rommel a field marshal the day after the capture of Tobruk caused Mussolini much pain, because, as Ciano noted, it accentuated the German character of the battle. The Duce left immediately for Libya to grab some honors for himself, believing that he could enter Alexandria, Ciano says, in 15 days. On July 2nd, he contacted Hitler by wire about the question of the future political government of Egypt, proposing Rommel as the military commander and an Italian as civilian delegate. Hitler replied that he did not consider the matter urgent. Ciano Diaries, pages 502 to 504. Mussolini was waiting impatiently in Derna, behind the front, General Fritz Bayerlein, chief of staff to Rommel, later recalled, for the day when he might take the salute at a parade of Axis tanks beneath the shadow of the pyramids. The Fatal Decisions, edited by Frieden and Richardson, page 103. Under the nagging of Admiral Raeder and the urging of Rommel, the Führer had only reluctantly agreed to send the Afrika Korps and a small German air force to Libya in the first place. But he had done this only to prevent an Italian collapse in North Africa, not because he foresaw the importance of conquering Egypt. The key to that conquest, actually, was the small island of Malta, lying in the Mediterranean between Sicily and the Axis bases in Libya. It was from this British bastion that bombers, submarines, and surface craft wrought havoc on German and Italian vessels carrying supplies and men to North Africa. In August 1941, some 35% of Rommel's supplies and reinforcements were sunk. In October, 63%. By November 9th, Chano was writing sadly in his diary, "Since September 19th, we had given up trying to get convoys through to Libya. Every attempt had been paid for at a high price. Tonight we tried it again. A convoy of 7 ships left, accompanied by 2 10,000-ton cruisers and 10 destroyers. All, I mean all, our ships were sunk. The British returned to their ports at Malta after having slaughtered us." Belatedly, the Germans diverted several U-boats from the Battle of the Atlantic to the Mediterranean, and Kesselring was given additional squadrons of planes for the bases in Sicily. It was decided to neutralize Malta and destroy, if possible, the British fleet in the eastern Mediterranean. Success was immediate. By the end of 1941, the British had lost 3 battleships, an aircraft carrier, 2 cruisers, and several destroyers and submarines. And what was left of their fleet was driven to Egyptian bases. Malta had been battered by German bombers day and night for weeks. As a result, Axis supplies got through. In January, not a ton of shipping was lost, and Rommel was able to build up his forces for the big push into Egypt. In March, Admiral Raeder talked Hitler into approving plans not only for Rommel's offensive toward the Nile, Operation Naida, but for the capture of Malta by parachute troops, Operation Hercules. The drive from Libya was to begin at the end of May, and Malta was to be assaulted in mid-July. But on June 15th, while Rommel was in the midst of his initial successes, Hitler postponed the attack on Malta. He could spare neither troops nor planes from the Russian front, he explained to Raeder. A few weeks later, he postponed Hercules again, saying it could wait until after the summer offensive in the east had been completed and Rommel had conquered Egypt. Malta could be kept quiet in the meantime, he advised, by continued bombing. But it was not kept quiet, and for this failure, either to neutralize it or to capture it, the Germans would shortly pay a high price. A large British convoy got through to the besieged island on June 16th, and though several warships and freighters were lost, this put Malta back in business. Spitfires were flown to the island from the U.S. aircraft carrier Wasp and soon drove the attacking Luftwaffe bombers from the skies. Rommel felt the effect. 3/4 of his supply ships thereafter were sunk. He had reached El Alamein with just 13 operational tanks. According to General Beierlein's post-war testimony, he probably exaggerated his losses. Allied intelligence gave Rommel 125 tanks. "Our strength," he wrote in his diary on July 3rd, "has faded away. And at a moment when the pyramids were almost in sight, and beyond, the great prize of Egypt and Suez, this was another opportunity lost, and one of the last which Hitler would be afforded by Providence and the fortunes of war." The German Summer Offensive in Russia, 1942. By the end of the summer of 1942, Adolf Hitler seemed to be once more on top of the world. German U-boats were sinking 700,000 tons of British-American shipping a month in the Atlantic, more than could be replaced in the booming shipyards of the United States, Canada, and Scotland. Though the Führer had denuded his forces in the west of most of their troops and tanks and planes in order to finish with Russia, there was no sign that summer that the British and Americans were strong enough to make even a small landing from across the Channel. They had not even risked trying to occupy French-held Northwest Africa, though the weakened French of divided loyalties had nothing much with which to stop them even if they attempted to, and the Germans nothing at all except a few submarines and a handful of planes based in Italy and Tripoli. The British Navy and Air Force had been unable to prevent Germany's 2 battle cruisers, Scharnhorst and Gneisenau, and the heavy cruiser Prince Eugen, from dashing up the English Channel in full daylight and making their way safely home from Brest. This had taken place on February 11th to 12th, 1942, and had caught the British by surprise. Only weak naval and aircraft forces were rounded up in time to attack the German fleet, and they inflicted little damage. Vice Admiral Ciliax, who led the dash, commented the Times of London, "has succeeded where the Duke of Medina Sidonia failed. Nothing more mortifying to the pride of sea power has happened in home waters since the 17th century. Hitler had feared that the British and Americans would certainly try to occupy northern Norway. That was why he had insisted on the dash from Brest so that the three heavy ships there could be used for the defense of Norwegian waters. Norway, he told Raeder at the end of January 1942, is the zone of destiny. It had to be defended at all costs. As it turned out, there was no need. The Anglo-Americans had other plans for their limited forces in the West. On the map, the sum of Hitler's conquests by September 1942 looked staggering. The Mediterranean had become practically an Axis lake, with Germany and Italy holding most of the northern shore from Spain to Turkey and the southern shore from Tunisia to within 60 miles of the Nile. In fact, German troops now stood guard from the Norwegian North Cape on the Arctic Ocean to Egypt, from the Atlantic at Brest to the southern reaches of the Volga River on the border of Central Asia. German troops of the Sixth Army had reached the Volga just north of Stalingrad on August 23rd. 2 days before, the swastika had been hoisted on Mount Elbrus, the highest peak, 18,481 feet, in the Caucasus Mountains. The Mykop oil fields, producing annually 2.5 million tons of oil, had been captured on August 8th. Though the Germans found them almost completely destroyed, and by the 25th, Kleist's tanks had arrived at Mozdok, only 50 miles from the main Soviet oil center around Grozny, and a bare 100 miles from the Caspian Sea. On the 31st, Hitler was urging Field Marshal List, commander of the armies in the Caucasus, to scrape up all available forces for the final push to Grozny so that he could get his hands on the oil fields. On that last day of August, too, Rommel launched his offensive at El Alamein with every hope of breaking through to the Nile. Although Hitler was never satisfied with the performance of his generals, he had sacked Field Marshal von Bock, who commanded the whole southern offensive on July 13th, and, as Halder's diary reveals, had constantly nagged and cursed most of the other commanders, as well as the general staff, for not advancing fast enough, he now believed that the decisive victory was in his grasp. He ordered the 6th Army and the 4th Panzer Army to swing north along the Volga, after Stalingrad was taken, in a vast encircling movement, which would enable him eventually to advance on Central Russia and Moscow from the east, as well as from the west. He believed the Russians were finished, and Halder tells of him at this moment talking of pushing with part of his forces through Iran to the Persian Gulf. Soon he would link up with the Japanese in the Indian Ocean. He had no doubt of the accuracy of a German intelligence report on September 9th that the Russians had used up all their reserves on the entire front. In a conference with Admiral Raeder at the end of August, his thoughts were already turning from Russia, which he said he now regarded as a blockade-proof Lebensraum, to the British and Americans, who would soon, he was sure, be brought to the point of discussing peace terms. And yet, as General Kurt Zeitzler later recalled, appearances even then, rosy as they were deceptive. Almost all the generals in the field, as well as those on the general staff, saw flaws in the pretty picture. They could be summed up. The Germans simply didn't have the resources, the men or the guns or the tanks or the planes or the means of transportation, to reach the objectives Hitler had insisted on setting. When Rommel tried to tell this to the warlord in respect to Egypt, Hitler ordered him to go on sick leave in the mountains of the Semmering. When Halder and Field Marshal List attempted to do the same in regard to the Russian front, they were cashiered. Even the rankest amateur strategist could see the growing danger to the German armies in southern Russia as Soviet resistance stiffened in the Caucasus and at Stalingrad, and the season of the autumn rains approached. The long northern flank of the 6th Army was dangerously exposed along the line of the Upper Don for 350 miles from Stalingrad to Voronezh. Here Hitler had stationed three satellite armies, the Hungarian 2nd south of Voronezh, the Italian 8th, farther southeast, and the Romanian 3rd, on the right at the bend of the Don just west of Stalingrad. Because of the bitter hostility of Romanians and Hungarians to each other, their armies had to be separated by the Italians. In the steppes south of Stalingrad, there was a 4th satellite army, the Romanian 4th. Aside from their doubtful fighting qualities, all these armies were inadequately equipped, lacking armored power, heavy artillery, and mobility. Furthermore, they were spread out very thinly. The Romanian Third Army held a front of 105 miles with only 69 battalions. But these Allied armies were all Hitler had. There were not enough German units to fill the gap, and since he believed, as he told Holder, that the Russians were finished, he did not unduly worry about this exposed and lengthy Don flank. Yet it was the key to maintaining both the 6th Army and the 4th Panzer Army at Stalingrad and Army Group A in the Caucasus. Should the Don flank collapse, not only would the German forces at Stalingrad be threatened with encirclement, but those in the Caucasus would be cut off. Once more, the Nazi warlord had gambled. It was not his first gamble of the summer's campaign. On July 23rd, at the height of the offensive, he made another. The Russians were in full retreat between the Donets and Upper Don rivers, falling rapidly back toward Stalingrad to the east and toward the Lower Don to the south. A decision had to be made. Should the German forces concentrate on taking Stalingrad and blocking the Volga River? Or should they deliver their main blow in the Caucasus in quest of Russian oil? Earlier in the month, Hitler had pondered this crucial question, but had been unable to make up his mind. At first, the smell of oil had tempted him most, and on July 13th he had detached the 4th Panzer Army from Army Group B, which had been driving down the Don toward the river's bend and Stalingrad just beyond, and sent it south to help Kleist's 1st Panzer Army get over the lower Don near Rostov and on into the Caucasus toward the oil fields. At that moment, the 4th Panzer Army probably could have raced on to Stalingrad, which was then largely undefended, and easily captured it. By the time Hitler realized his mistake, it was too late, and then he compounded his error. When the 4th Panzer Army was shifted back toward Stalingrad a fortnight later, the Russians had recovered sufficiently to be able to check it, and its departure from the Caucasus front left Kleist too weak to complete his drive to the Grozny oil fields. Kleist confirmed this to Little Heart. The 4th Panzer Army could have taken Stalingrad without a fight at the end of July, but was diverted south to help me in crossing the Don. I did not need its aid, and it merely congested the roads I was using. When it turned north again a fortnight later, the Russians had gathered just sufficient forces at Stalingrad to check it. By that time, Kleist needed the additional tank force. We could have reached our goal, the Grozny oil, if my forces had not been drawn away to help the attack on Stalingrad, he added. Little Heart, The German General's Talk, pages 169 to 171. The shifting of this powerful armored unit back to the drive on Stalingrad was one result of the fatal decision which Hitler made on July 23rd. His fanatical determination to take both Stalingrad and the Caucasus at the same time, against the advice of Holder and the field commanders, who did not believe it could be done, was embodied in Directive No. 45, which became famous in the annals of the German army. It was one of the most fateful of Hitler's moves in the war, for in the end, and in a very short time, it resulted in his failing to achieve either objective and led to the most humiliating defeat in the history of German arms, making certain that he could never win the war and that the days of the thousand-year Third Reich were numbered. General Halder was appalled, and there was a stormy scene at Werewolf headquarters in the Ukraine near Vinnytsia, to which Hitler had moved on July 16th in order to be nearer the front. The chief of the general staff urged that the main forces be concentrated on the taking of Stalingrad, and tried to explain that the German army simply did not possess the strength to carry out two powerful offensives in two different directions. When Hitler retorted that the Russians were finished, Holder attempted to convince him that, according to the army's own intelligence, this was far from the case. The continual underestimation of enemy possibilities, Holder noted sadly in his diary that evening, takes on grotesque forms and is becoming dangerous. Serious work has become impossible here. Pathological reaction to momentary impressions and a complete lack of capacity to assess the situation and its possibilities give this so-called leadership a most peculiar character. Later, the chief of the general staff, whose own days at his post were now numbered, would come back to this scene and write, "Hitler's decisions had ceased to have anything in common with the principles of strategy and operations, as they have been recognized for generations past. They were the product of a violent nature following its momentary impulses, which recognized no limits to possibility and which made its wish dreams the father of its acts." As to what he called the Supreme Commander's pathological overestimation of his own strength and criminal underestimation of the enemy's, Holder later told a story. Once, when a quite objective report was read to him showing that still in 1942 Stalin would be able to muster from 1 to 1.25 million fresh troops in the region north of Stalingrad and west of the Volga, not to mention 500,000 men in the Caucasus, and which provided proof that Russian output of frontline tanks amounted to at least 1,200 a month, Hitler flew at the man who was reading with clenched fists and foam in the corners of his mouth and forbade him to read any more of such idiotic twaddle. "You didn't have to have the gift of a prophet," says Halder, "to foresee what would happen when Stalin unleashed those 1.5 million troops against Stalingrad and the Don flank. I pointed this out to Hitler very clearly. The result was the dismissal of the chief of the Army General Staff." Halder relates that, quite by accident, he came across in the Ukraine about that time a book about Stalin's defeat of General Denikin between the Don Bend and Stalingrad during the Russian Civil War. He says the situation then was very similar to that of 1942, and that Stalin exploited masterfully Denikin's weak defenses along the Don. Hence, he adds, came the changing of the name of the city from Tsaritsyn to Stalingrad. This took place on September 24th. Already on the 9th, upon being told by Keitel that Field Marshal List, who had the overall command of the armies in the Caucasus, had been sacked, Halder learned that he would be the next to go. The Führer, he was told, had become convinced that he was no longer equal to the psychic demands of his position. Hitler explained this in greater detail to his General Staff Chief at their farewell meeting on the 24th. "You and I have been suffering from nerves. Half of my nervous exhaustion is due to you. It is not worth it to go on. We need National Socialist ardor now, not professional ability. I cannot expect this of an officer of the old school such as you." So spoke, Halder commented later, not a responsible warlord, but a political fanatic. And so departed Franz Halder. He was not without his faults, which were similar to those of his predecessor, General Beck, in that his mind was often confused and his will to action paralyzed. And though he had often stood up to Hitler, however ineffectually, he had also, like all of the other army officers who enjoyed high rank during World War II, gone along with him, and for a long time abetted his outrageous aggressions and his conquests. Yet he had retained some of the virtues of more civilized times. He was the last of the old-school General Staff Chiefs that the Army of the Third Reich would have. He was replaced by General Kurt Zeitzler, a younger officer of a different stripe who was serving as Chief of Staff to Rundstedt in the West, and who endured in the post, which once, especially in the First World War, had been the highest and most powerful in the German Army, as little more than the Führer's office boy until the attempt against the dictator's life in July 1944. The sacking of Halder was a loss not only to the army but to historians of the Third Reich, for his invaluable diary ends on September 24, 1942. He was eventually arrested, placed in the concentration camp at Dachau along with such illustrious prisoners as Schuschnigg and Schacht, and liberated by U.S. forces at Niederdorf, South Tyrol, on April 28, 1945. Since then, up to the time of writing, he has collaborated with the U.S. Army in a number of military historical studies of World War II. His generosity to this writer in answering queries and pointing out sources has already been noted. The faithful and fanatically loyal General Jodl, chief of operations at OKW, also was in Hitler's doghouse at this time. He had opposed the sacking of Field Marshal List and General Halder, and his defense of them sent Hitler into such a rage that for months he refused to shake hands with Jodl or dine with him or any other staff officer. Hitler was on the point of firing Jodl at the end of January 1943 and replacing him with General Paulus, but it was too late. Paulus, as we shall shortly see, was no longer available. A change in General Staff Chiefs did not change the situation of the German army, whose twin drives on Stalingrad and the Caucasus had now been halted by stiffening Soviet resistance. All through October, bitter street fighting continued in Stalingrad itself. The Germans made some progress, from building to building, but with staggering losses, for the rubble of a great city, as everyone who has experienced modern warfare knows, gives many opportunities for stubborn and prolonged defense, and the Russians, disputing desperately every foot of the debris, made the most of them. Though Halder and then his successor warned Hitler that the troops in Stalingrad were becoming exhausted, the Supreme Commander insisted that they push on. Fresh divisions were thrown in and were soon ground to pieces in the inferno. Instead of a means to an end, the end had already been achieved when German formations reached the western banks of the Volga north and south of the city and cut off the river's traffic. Stalingrad had become an end in itself. To Hitler, its capture was now a question of personal prestige. Even when Zeitzler got up enough nerve to suggest to the Führer that in view of the danger to the long northern flank along the Don, the Sixth Army should be withdrawn from Stalingrad to the elbow of the Don, Hitler flew into a fury. "Where the German soldier sets foot, there he remains," he stormed. Despite the hard going and the severe losses, General Paulus, commander of the Sixth Army, informed Hitler by radio on October 25th that he expected to complete the capture of Stalingrad at the latest by November 10th. Cheered up by this assurance, Hitler issued orders the next day that the Sixth Army and the Fourth Panzer Army, which was fighting south of the city, should prepare to push north and south along the Volga as soon as Stalingrad had fallen. It was not that Hitler was ignorant of the threat to the Don flank. The OKW diaries make clear that it caused him considerable worry. The point is that he did not take it seriously enough, and that, as a consequence, he did nothing to avert it. Indeed, so confident was he that the situation was well in hand, that on the last day of October, he, the staff of OKW, and the Army General Staff abandoned their headquarters at Vinnytsia in the Ukraine and returned to Wolfschanze at Rastenburg. The Führer had practically convinced himself that if there were to be any Soviet winter offensive at all, it would come on the central and northern fronts. He could handle that better from his quarters in East Prussia. Hardly had he returned there when bad news reached him from another and more distant front. Field Marshal Rommel's Afrika Corps was in trouble.